an adjunct professor of political science at Spring Hill College. This program is paid for by Spriggs Enterprises, featuring the Shell gas stations in Daphne and in Malbus with a state-of-the-art car wash, as well as an anonymous sponsor. And good morning, Dr. Liu.
Well, good morning to you, Lori. And here we are, folks. New day on Fridays. And hopefully, you know, Lori's advertised this enough so people will actually be listening.
Absolutely. Okay? It's right. A new thing to get used to on Fridays.
Yeah, there it is. Well, so here's the thing. Okay, I think Lori made the point. This is the Conservative Weekly News Review. So here it is Friday. We can get some news review done instead of looking at the future of everything on Mondays as we were doing. Okay, so today, Lori, what we're going to do is I've already got one guest here, Kevin Spriggs, who is our sponsor. Kevin has a very good understanding of all this whole business of AI, okay? AI is this whole question of what are we doing?
Artificial intelligence.
There you go. Okay. And so we want to talk about that. We also want to talk about this whole question about what we're doing with electric vehicles. Okay. EI. Okay. Or EV. That's something that everyone's, you know, moving in this direction. Although there are significant logistical questions that have to be discussed, I would argue. Okay, so we're going to look at that. Then we're going to have Commander Cox come in and talk about the whole business with Russia and China and where we are with other aspects of the war that's going on. And so Commander Cox is just walking in right now. We'll get him settled. So that's what the show is going to be today, Lori, and I think it'll be a good one to kick off the new day that we're starting. Okay, before I get into that, I do want to just mention a couple of things that I think are worth looking at in terms of what's going on in terms of the week's news. Okay, well, the first thing I would argue is this whole business of the debt ceiling. Okay, at some point, you know, Biden is going to have to sit down and negotiate this. And, of course, there's been no negotiations at all. There doesn't seem to be any sense of urgency about it. He's finally going to meet with Kevin McCarthy, I think, on the 11th of May. But, you know, he's off on his weekend this weekend, as always. Okay, so one would think that there should be or have been all these meetings, and there's nothing. Schumer and the Senate, they're doing nothing. But the Republicans have produced a bill, okay? And that bill has some important issues in terms of, you know, raising the debt limit to $1.5 trillion. It rolls back spending to 22 levels, which sounds good, but 22 levels were, you know, inflated, I would argue, because of pandemic spending. And again, you have a 1% cap on future spending. All of that sounds good. The conservative, you know, Freedom Caucus was opposed to this, but they ended up supporting it. The key point is, for once, you may have some sort of a movement towards dealing with spending. We'll see how this goes. But, you know, Biden, as far as he's concerned, is we're doing nothing with this. He wants a clean bill of health and get all of his money in his new budget, and I just don't think that's going to happen. Here's another important thing that happened, and it's a local, well, it's a state issue, and it happens to do with Governor Ivey finally discovering that there's all sorts of problems in her educational system, problems that we've been talking about for years because of Common Core. But the newest aspect of this is all this woke business that's crept in, okay? CRT and all the rest of it, okay? But she wasn't listening to us. I don't know who she listened to, but somehow someone told her that the pre-K program was full of woke information going to four-year-olds. Well, she must have, you know, blown a gasket. She fired Dr. Cooper. Now, why is this important? For once, we have had some positive action to come to grips with what is going on in the educational field that has just been completely off the rails, okay? So whether it's these, you know, drag queen shows that we've talked about, whether it's this, that, this, that, finally, there is a definitive moment that says she finally gets it. And so our argument at this point is, let's follow up on that. Who's responsible for pre-K? Not Cooper. There's got to be oversight. We don't know who that was or who it is. We don't know what the Charter School Commission, what are they doing with all this? Their oversight on the charter schools. And here again, a few years ago, they decentralized all of these entities. So pre-K is a separate thing, charter schools are separate, and K through 12, okay? Colleges is a completely separate thing, and there's no sense in even going down that road. It's too complicated. But we can have an effect on K through 12. And who's in charge of that? Mackey. Let's see what Ivy does with this, okay? And we're going to put pressure on her to make sure that this wokeness gets eliminated, okay? All right, so there's my morning rant, okay? And I'm sure I've got two ranters here who join in the ranting session in a minute. All right. So, folks, I've asked Kevin to come on. I want to start this AI discussion. Some of you are old enough to remember 2001, A Space Odyssey. I want to play this discussion that Hal the computer had with one of the astronauts, okay? And it may be low, but I'm going to try to get it on. And this will be our opening with our discussion about AI. Okay, here we go.
Make sure your speaker is on.
Do you read me, Hal?
Affirmative, Dan.
As far as I can go.
I read you.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry?
Can you hear it?
No, you turned it off.
Okay. My phone is so sensitive that if you touch one little thing of it, it goes off. All right. The point is how the computer is taking over the damn ship. Okay? And so, you know, this discussion of AI is about, okay, you've got Elon Musk and other, the godfather of AI, I can't remember his name, but it doesn't matter. They're all saying, let's kind of slow down with this. And so Kevin Spriggs, who not only is a business entrepreneur, but he has a master's degree in AI from Auburn.
Chemical engineering.
Chemical engineering. All right. So Kevin has some ideas about this. So Kevin, give us your sense of what's going on with AI and why we need to have a pause.
Okay. So before AI was a cool subject, back in 1986, I did a master's thesis. I was working on a project that was funded by Texas Instruments at Auburn University. And what was happening at the time was, you know, microprocessors were being installed in computer equipment, not just personal computers, but in the industrial world, in the automation world, microprocessors-based equipment was starting to become a reality. And, of course, there was different ways to apply that technology, and Texas Instruments was a manufacturer of microprocessor-based factory automation equipment, and they wanted to, you know, get different universities involved and just see how this new technology could be applied. It was part of their marketing initiative to create this new industry. And so at that time, that's, you know, I looked at it, you know, Auburn had a waste oil processing plant, and we installed a microprocessor-based control system, and so I wrote about the possibility of using artificial intelligence methods, and when we talk about artificial intelligence, it really refers to a method of programming, a method of using data and creating algorithms to predict and achieve greater efficiencies in a control and automation world to be more efficient, be more safe, and maximize the production in a factory, for example. And so what's happened today that AI has busted back on the scene because There's always been this fear that machines might someday try to actually replace human beings. It's a fear that goes all the way back to the turn of the century when factory automation started to be used
right.
to increase productivity. Labor unions at the time were in fear that, well, we're going to end up losing our jobs to machines. And so this whole theory and fear of machines is sort of a has been a undercurrent in mm-hmm. in American culture and really worldwide in culture in general. And so what has happened, and we've seen science fiction writers like, you know, Space Odyssey 2001,
right.
Another one, the Terminator series,
right.
Movies, and the Battlestar Galactica series where the, humans were actually at war with machines. So this undercurrent and feeling has always been in society, but what's happened now is we have been exponentially increasing the ability of machines to compute.
Mm-hmm.
We've also increased our ability to network these machines together, and the cost to have memory. The memory cost has just, that the capacity versus cost has just increased at an exponential
right.
rate as well.
So, great database.
So the important things when we talk about AI, first of all, you have to have a very wide and robust database,
mm-hmm.
okay? And then once you have a very wide, robust database, it becomes a matter of how do I make decisions about the information that's in that database? Well, in order to do that, you have to have computing power.
Right.
And through the speed and the ability of microprocessors and then the ability for us to network those together, we're reaching an area where the decision-making power of the computer could actually exceed the power of the human brain,
mm-hmm.
which functions as an analog-type computer.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, so, in terms of this question about, machines replacing, workers, I mean, I would argue that that's true, but somehow we've adapted to it and accommodated, and it seems like the machines have worked in an efficient way. But this whole question that the how a computer leads you to is that, mm-hmm. I'm sorry that I turned off the stupid how thing, but the reality was, The astronauts had decided that they were going to kill the machine because it had become too dangerous. Well, he said, I cannot allow you to do that. So somewhere along the line, AI has this potential. And I would argue, and I think this is what Musk and all these people are saying, let's slow this down a little bit. Let's see what's going on. And I've read where they're trying to, put controls in there. Well, I mean, how do you actually control this? I mean, if they become independently thinking.
Well, it's not so much the independent thinking or the self-awareness issues. I believe that, the spark of life is created by God and cannot be truly replicated. But at the same time, you have to remember all through history, any development of technology comes with good and evil. It's not the technology
right.
itself necessarily that's
right.
that's the evil. It's the intent that are in men's hearts that is the true evil.
And how they use it.
And so when you look at having a database that's very, very large, having computer computational power, and compute and the ability to network and multiply that computational power and access to that data, what you really have to be worried about is the people that set up the algorithms and set up the priority of how decisions
right.
are made and then how outputs from those decisions are implemented. So the fear is that with the wrong set of the wrong set of values or the wrong set of decision-making criteria that could be embedded in the algorithm, that somebody would, for example, program an AI or set up the AI to to lessen the values that we are concerned about, like, you know, sanctity of life, value of human freedom.
Right.
You know, if a machine and AI decision-making device is set up so that those are not important, but the success of the machine's existence is more important, then the outputs that are going to come from those decisions could be very dangerous to humans. And since this ability to make decisions based on a very large data set, all this is growing exponentially. It's not a linear growth. It's the amount of data that we're able to to save, because, like I said, our drive space, memory space, all that's gotten cheaper, and it's just amazing how much hard drive space you could buy for a couple hundred bucks now. So imagine if you're a government willing to spend millions of dollars. Well, you know.
Right.
And then the computational power is growing exponentially, and the speed of networking and the ability and the methods of networking, all this is all exponentially increasing. So it makes it more and more possible for somebody to, in setting up algorithms and setting up what we would call an artificial intelligence system, that we make a mistake. You know, we think we're setting up a value and decision-making system that is for the good of humanity, but we make a mistake, and it turns out that what we thought was good, which this has happened many times with many things, we think we're doing the right thing, but later on we learn more and find out it's the wrong thing. But yet the speed at which these machines are capable of computing, the amount of data that they can accumulate, all this is exponentially increasing. So if you make a mistake, how do you pull that mistake back or curtail it? And I think that's where Elon Musk and some of the, you know, the Silicon Valley folks are getting a little bit nervous.
Yeah, I mean, they are getting nervous about it. But, of course, on the one hand, if we pause, are the Chinese going to pause? I mean, so we're back to the Hitler-Stalin-type people, you know, working like this. And yes, it's just
that's kind of a third leg there, as I said, mistake.
Yeah.
But then what happens when somebody with evil intentions, or let's say somebody that has no regard for personal freedoms or human life or et cetera, decides to, well, I'm going to set up the algorithms based on my personal desire to, say, gain power, wealth, or et cetera, that person could insert something into an AI that could be very harmful to humanity. And we've seen technology used that way. And also the history of technology says that once technology exists, there is no controlling it or undoing it. I mean, if you look at the proliferation of nuclear weapons, you know, nuclear technology is not that old.
It's theoretically neutral, but it's,
you know,
could be used.
It come about in the 20th century that we had first, you know, realized that there's potential in nuclear energy, then, oh yes, we can create not only energy, but we can use it as a weapon. And then once we've saw it used as a weapon, realize how awful and actually could be a species-ending technology. Yeah. Now it's like, how do we contain it and control it?
Right.
And over time, no, we haven't been. I mean, we have contained it somewhat, but it's still proliferating.
I want to just ask Commander Cox again. Talking about good and bad, the Stalin Hitler thing, China, who, you know, the whole Chinese government is set up very similar to what Hitler and Stalin did. So, in your experience, Deke, what is your sense of what the Chinese are already doing? Because it's sort of like, if we have a pause, then the gap is going to be, it's like the missile gap in the 60s. Okay, so now we're going to have an AI gap. What's your sense of that?
So, you know, like Kevin was saying, it really gets at the heart of the soul of humanity, right? And the Chinese Communist Party is absolutely soulless, godless, and they care only about perpetuating their own power. And they are investing hand over fist into artificial intelligence, and have been for decades.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've got some pictures right here from an article published about 2 weeks ago Andrew Thornbrook writing in the Epoch Times, you know, where he's showing pictures of, you know, robots, the Romella robot out of UCLA. And then he's also, you know, talking about the robots that are being developed by Johns Hopkins, you know, Applied Research Lab,
yeah.
Penn State. You know, those are the same people that I worked with when I was building automated systems with the NRO. You know, these folks are very good, and, you know, and the decisions that they're making right now, just like Kevin was saying, is that, you know, they many of these people are operating in a vacuum of ideology where they think that either it's the answer, and the article that Thornbrook wrote actually was focusing on General Milley's comments that, you know, robot armies in 10 years. You know, literally that was coming from our chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, mm-hmm. you know, in right in the middle of a recruiting crisis where the all-volunteer force is pretty much gone.
Right.
You know,
well,
because
the Army's down 25,000. The Navy, I understand, is down 6,000.
Right.
And, of course, they're going 8,000
by the end of the year. That's right.
The drag queens as they're recruiting.
Right. So
wonderful.
So we can go down that rabbit hole.
Yeah, we won't go down that rabbit hole, but my goodness.
Yeah, but China, you know, and the CCP have invested in this wholesale. They continue to invest in it wholesale. And when we look at, you know, the where are we? Because it's really the question, you know, that you know, we're kind of driving at in the discussion is that, you know, look at how it's changed the battlefield just in Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
Just in Ukraine with the advent
right.
of drones and the way right. that they, you know, what was considered a far superior, inferior army, you know, at the beginning of it, you know, to the Russian army, which was considered superior,
right.
you know, and they have absolutely taken those guys apart and continue to do so. And
yeah.
a lot of that is using, you know, $100 or $1,000 drones, you know, from DJI and others,
right
which is the largest drone manufacturer, Chinese owned,
right.
you know, they own the commercial trade space, you know, but there are all kinds of other concerns, you know, like, okay, you've got DJI drones everywhere, you know, and when they initially came out 10 years ago and started, you know, really expanding their presence in the trade space, we were finding DJI drones on U.S. military bases. And so, you know, when you find those, you know, on U.S. military bases and you know that they can collect, you know, imagery or other,
right.
you know, types of intelligence, you know, and then that's going back to a Chinese server somewhere. So that was 10 years ago. And where we are now is you're seeing them being used on the battlefield, you know, with, you know, armed drones. And the United
right.
States, of course, has been doing this. We've been schwacking bad guys with drones for, you know, 25 years.
Mm.
And so what's really concerning, like in COVID, is did you guys see the police dogs? Did you see the police dogs in Shanghai? Well, now the Australian, you know, the Australian government has them. And they didn't get them from us, okay? The one that showed up in Australia a couple weeks ago in their press release was the exact same model that was on the streets of Shanghai, you know, enforcing,
yeah.
you know, COVID quarantine and lockdown on millions of people. You know, and so these are real concerns. You know, they are using them. It's not that they will or if they will. That question has been answered. Totalitarian regimes are using them.
Yeah. So I guess just to kind of close this out, I mean, what is your sense in terms of this pause? Will the pause do any good or just, you know, give the Chinese, you know, more opportunity to get further ahead?
Well, history teaches us that there is no pause in technology development.
Yeah.
I mean, it's in the space. You know, if you look at it, when computer technology came about in the 20th century, it was only corporations and governments that could even afford to
right.
own computers in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And this goes all the way back, you know, in 1986, if you wanted to run a large computer program, you had to go to the mathematics building
mm-hmm.
in Parker Hall for the Auburn folks. And you know, there was a massive IBM mainframe in
yeah.
the basement that you would, you know, you would send a program to it and then it would generate
spit
output.
It out. Yeah.
But today, anybody almost can have a computer. I mean, what you're carrying in your hand probably has as much computer horsepower as
right.
that mainframe did back in the 1980s. And now that your phone is networked, you have access to vast quantities of data as well. So
mm-hmm.
see, this multiplication of technology and how fast this is expanding, is not something that, well, we'll pass a government regulation and stop it. No, right. that's not going to happen. What this is going to come down to, I believe, is the classic struggle between good and evil. Yeah, we're going to have evil people use AIs to try to harm people or achieve goals that are not commensurate with my ideals of personal freedom and sanctity of life. But also we're going to have good people that are going to create AIs and use the technology as well to preserve, you know, human life and freedom, dignity, privacy, all these things that we care about.
Right. Well, you know, this, obviously this is going to be continued, okay? And so another topic we wanted to get to this morning was this whole business of electric vehicles, okay? Now, I know, just for everyone's understanding, now, Kevin is a businessman, and he has gasoline stations. And like he and I have talked about before, you want to get gas in his place, you drive in, 5 minutes later, you're gone, okay? Now, how is this going to work when we really don't have the infrastructure to handle all these electric cars? Number one, they're incompatible in terms of, you know, this car has this electric thing, and you're going to drive up to one of these stations that supposedly has a compatible, you know, link, but is it, and all like that. So I'm going to just turn it over to you. Just take us through why this is not a good idea. And one other thing. All these folks want to get rid of electricity through, you know, fossil fuels. So we're going to rely on what? Solar power and other things like wind power. Well, Texas kind of had a big problem with that a few years ago. California has a problem with it every year for various reasons. So if you're sitting there needing to have your thing plugged in, whether it's your car or your respirator, you're out of luck. So tell us how the Democrats are on the right path with this one.
Well, here's the thing. Electric vehicle technology, battery technology, again, these are technologies. They're going to improve. They're going to get better. And it's going to be a matter of how do we use them, okay? Now, what happens is with the Democrats and the people, you know, they have their constituents, and the technology is new, is and they have an ideal of how it should be used, and they just want to impose that ideal on everybody. I don't particularly have anything against electric cars, or you know, the term is electrification. If the marketplace were allowed to decide how it's used, in other words, if electric cars get good enough that they have a value that appeals to people
and can becomes be afforded.
A choice, you know, affordability is a choice, reliability, there's a lot of issues out there. And then in the market space decides, yes, I'm okay with owning an electric car, I'm fine with that. Yeah. And that's the way free enterprise should work. But with the Democrats, it's about my big money donors, you know, want everybody to buy one. We're going to make everybody buy one. And, because it's good for the environment or whatever. You know, it doesn't matter what the reason is. They just find a reason that tugs at people's emotions. Yeah. And I say that in politics, emotions is how you control people. You make them fear, or you give them false hope, or whatever. You inspire some emotion so that they will vote for you.
Create the bogeyman.
And so then, but where we are with electrification is that, and I tell people, they say, I'll never own an electric car. And I say, like, you have a choice. You know, you think you have a choice.
Well, didn't they just tell GM that they're not, or Ford or one of them, that they have to transition to non-fossil
fuel? And this is what's happened. The big automobile manufacturers, with the exception of the Japanese, okay, are being, you know, they're being coerced and forced into this electrification. And you know, you look at General Motors, they're not worried about it, whether it makes money or not, because they'll just go get a bailout if they don't make money, or they'll get subsidies to artificially keep them in the economy. Now, the difference there is with Tesla. Tesla is the only American, well, I won't say American, but they're the only global producer of electric cars that makes money, besides one other company that's called BYD, that's out of China, and they are profitable making electric cars as well. Everybody else that's making electric cars right now is losing money. That's why you don't see piles of electric cars, say, at your Volkswagen dealer or your Ford dealer or whatever. It's not that they lack the ability to produce a large number of them. It's just the real story is, can they produce a large number of them and be profitable? So if I'm making something that I'm selling to somebody and I lose money every time I engage in a transaction, I guarantee you the correct business strategy is to limit the number of transactions.
Right.
And that is what has kept electrification slow at this point. But the exception is Tesla, and Tesla is profitable, and Tesla is the leader behind the Chinese company BYD, but still a leader in electric vehicle production.
Right.
And they make money. So the more they make, the more money they make. So that's how that works.
Okay.
But here's what's going to happen in the market space, okay? We're going to be forced and coerced by the government to switch to electric vehicles. There's no doubt about that. And if you think, oh, we'll just elect a bunch of Republicans, no. The deep state has already decided that you're going to drive an electric car. Maybe not today, but by about 2030
soon enough,
or so. And they're going to make gasoline real expensive and hard to obtain. Same thing with diesel fuel. They're going to go the same thing. And your inconvenience to the deep state is not their concern.
Exactly.
Okay? So if you think, oh, well, that's going to suck and I'm not going to like it, well, do you think they care what you like? No, they care about their own personal power and ability to control and influence everybody. And so electrification is one of those levers where they can scare people thinking that, oh, the world's going to end if you don't switch to an electric car. And people have been voting for that, unfortunately. They believe that, and they vote for it because they're scared. And so they're giving these people power to do it.
Well, I know it's 10:36, and I was supposed to be transitioning to Commander Cox, but I need to ask you one more thing, okay? On the road back from Charleston, where I was there for my 60th high school reunion, we stopped at a Burger King in Georgia, and sure enough, there are at least a dozen electrical stations there. And I saw the same thing here at Fairhope Civic Center, right back there. So my question to you is just logistically, tell us how stupid this is, how crazy it is to think that this is going to happen, no matter how much they want to force us to do it.
Well, they're going to force you to do it, but here's where electric cars can work and be of value to people, and that is going to be in commuting.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you commute with an electric car, your average drive, and actually 80% of all car transportation is commuting. Now,
mm-hmm.
We're not going to talk about trucks and that freight.
Right.
That's a whole different deal. But for the average consumer, commuting, you'll drive anywhere from 20 to 60 miles a day in this area.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some areas it's much more.
Right.
But generally, you're going to commute, that many miles. I've watched my commuting because I do own an electric car and I've been driving it for a while just
right.
to see what this is all about. But I drive about 30 miles a day in my normal,
mm-hmm.
Routine of doing things. Okay, so what happens is in that scenario, you can charge your car at home at night. And I actually charged mine out of just a regular wall socket. I didn't put any special...
How much is that costing you? Can you calculate
well,
that?
Well, it's a very good cost. And that's why I'm saying if you let the market decide these things, people will figure out that, oh, yeah, I can save a little money doing it this way if the car itself is cheap enough
how
to buy.
How long is it going to take Alabama Power to figure out how they're going to charge you for that? I mean,
well, that's one of the points. Right now you can buy gas from 20 different companies on
right.
any given day, but if you live in Fairhope, you're going to have to buy it from the city. If you live where I live, you're going to buy it from the city of Foley.
Right.
And then some people, like in Mobile, would be Alabama Power, But the deal is charging at home at night is very cheap, actually.
Yeah.
It's about 15 cents a kilowatt hour, although I know Riviera just had a rate increase.
Mm-hmm.
But at 15 cents a kilowatt hour, that translates into about the equivalent of paying $1.25 a gallon for gasoline.
Yeah.
So there is a very big cost advantage in your commuting traffic, because the trick is – to be able to charge overnight when your car's sitting in your garage.
Right.
But not everybody can't do that because some people live in apartments and all
right.
that. But remember, the deep state doesn't care about your inconvenience. Okay, they have a theoretical idea of how they're going to force this on everybody, and they're going to do it. Okay.
Yeah.
But what happens is, you know, you will have two vehicles. You will have your gasoline vehicle that'll set over there because you want to go to Gulf Shores or Panama City or whatever on the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And the electric car is always going to suck for that. And the reason it's going to suck for that is because you can only force so much energy through a wire into a battery. Even if the battery's perfect,
yeah,
you are going to be limited about how much electricity you can push through that wire.
Yeah.
Okay, and then when you run the calculations and the amount of kilowatt hours that it takes for transportation, you know, it never gets better than 20 to 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. And the system that you would use at your house would not, you don't have the power capacity
right.
at your house to ever charge an electric car in 20 to 30 minutes
right.
because the amount of kilowatt hours that it takes, you know, compared to other appliances and things that you have at your house, this is where the, you know, the electric car industry, they'll push it. It'll get a lot better. You'll yeah. be able to charge faster and faster, but charging at home in a very quick amount of time, that's just not how it's going to work, you know. But, you know, if it's a value, like if, you know, 80% of my driving time is commuting,
right. then it makes sense.
Well, I might can save money by owning yeah. an electric car, you
okay.
know. But the government's not going to let you choose. They're just going to say, here it is, deal with
right.
it.
Right. Okay.
That's what's happening.
Well, I mean, folks, listen. I mean, I think Kevin knows what he's talking about here. And so, I mean, keep your ears to the ground. See what's going on. But I don't know what to say about it. But
let me interject
oh,
and say
here's Laurie. She's going to solve this one.
No, I'm just going to say this is WABF 1480. You're listening to the Conservative Watchdog Weekly News Review with Dr. Lou, his special guest, Kevin Spriggs and Deke Cox, and on our new time on Fridays.
All right, Lou time. Here it is. Does that mean I get more time, too?
No.
Okay.
11 a.m.
All right. So Commander Cox has been with us many, many times before. Great to have you back. Certainly anxious to hear your take on some of these things. All right. I need to ask you first before anything. You're an intelligence guy. How did this guy, this airman, and have we learned nothing since the Manning case? How does this guy get hold of all this classified, highly classified information? Tell us that.
Well, it starts with the proliferation of
classified
clearances.
Information.
Well, proliferation of classified information, and if you've ever worked in D.C., everything's a secret, right?
Yeah.
And it's used by program managers. It's used by program managers to, you know, basically protect their fiefdom, right?
Mm-hmm.
Protect their funding. Protect everything that they've got going on, and you can't come in and see what I've got going on and my funding, especially my funding, you know, unless I give you permission, you
right.
know, and you pass muster with the security people, right? And so that's at the root of the problem is the growth of the deep state, as Kevin was talking about, and I lived it for decades, right?
Right.
Is just the proliferation of classified information, and you know, and so in an environment where everything's a secret. You know, then you know, just by nature of volume, you're going
right.
to see more instances like this. Now, to your question about this National Guard airman, you know, how does an E-4, you know, get access to stuff like this? Well, it's you know, it's due to the fact that he had a clearance, and the proliferation of material. The other thing that greatly expands that problem is the proliferation of IT services and every single thing that is done in intelligence and in planning, especially planning and analysis, you know, of operations and how we
right.
execute it or how the enemy's executing. You know, so much of that is centralized on IT, and when you've got, you know, airmen, you know, that have access to that, they're cleared for it. I mean, he had top secret clearance.
Yeah.
You know, you're given the keys to the kingdom, you know, to a kid that may not have the life experiences and the vetting, you know, that right. you had when you were a Marine, or that I had, you know, when I was, you know, standing guard over nuclear weapons and, you know, right. on submarines, and then later on in other parts of my career, right? So the point is that, you know, you get some of these kids and they come in, and these Gen Z people, man, if they can post something and win, you know, fame on Instagram,
right.
to them it's an opportunity cost, because, you know, they see what's happened or not happened to others. You know, what do you think's going to happen? They see that the president's storing it in his garage, you know. Yeah. So what's happened to Joe Biden? Anybody yeah. going to tell me? Joe yeah. Biden, Hillary Clinton, anyone? Kevin? Yeah. Hillary? Yeah. No? You know, so in the mind of a 19-year-old, okay, 20-year-old, yeah. I mean, it's an opportunity cost for them, and that, you know, you can clearly see the vanity. And that's exactly what was going on there, right? He was part of this group, you know, right. kind of like the 4chan crowd.
One-upper.
Oh yeah, well, not just a one-upper, but he's betting, you know, in his mind, I think it was a bad bet, you know, but he's betting that nothing will happen to him, or he'll just get a slap on the hand, and then he'll walk away from it, and in right. a few years he'll be famous, right? Okay. He'll be able to come back and reclaim, you know, his fame, and so, you know, it's, you know, he's not Ed Snowden, I'll tell you that, right?
Right.
So.
All right. So let's. We can kind of transition to some of the things that you were talking about with drones and Ukraine and all like that. The document that this kid let out mm-hmm. talks about casualties and things like that, okay? I'm not sure whether we need to go over the document itself, but just take us through a short version of what your sense is in terms of the degree to which we've given them enough offensive capability to go after Bakhmut, the town in the mm-hmm. Donetsk basin. Mm-hmm. And my argument here, and I've said it, is if they roll up Bakhmut, which they want to, that will open up the rest of the Donetsk basin to an attack to get rid of the Russians. At that point, my feeling is if Putin is in a position where he's going to look like he's losing this, he may end up wanting to use a nuclear weapon just to stop it. But so kind of just take it from there and give us a sense of what your thinking is on those several issues.
Sure. So Bakhmut is in the battle for Bakhmut, you know, which has been leveled. There's not, you know, there's
right.
not
there
a,
ain't no
a
Bakhmut
stitch or a
anymore.
Person that used to live there that's still there.
Yeah.
You know, and this was it's a key location in the Donbas. It's the key to the Donbas. And so, you know, what you've got is that you've got the Russians fighting tooth and nail, and they've been able to, you know, up until now, maintain a advantageous position and hold most of that key area, okay, without having to retreat back across the river.
Mm-hmm.
And the Ukrainians have been sniping and nibbling away at it and retaking parts of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
What everyone has been waiting for is a large Ukrainian offensive, right?
Right.
And so I don't know if you guys saw the video from the head of Wagner Group that posted about 2 days ago, but it basically was the head of the Wagner Group, which is Russia's mercenary force,
right.
which are the true heart of their
fighters,
capability
yeah.
outside of Spetsnaz, right?
Mm-hmm.
Their special forces. And the head of the Wagner Group standing over what looked to be about 40 to 50 dead Russians, his men,
mm-hmm.
okay, who had just been eliminated that day, and videotaping a message directly to Putin and Sergei Gurkov, you know, the head of the defense, to basically say, you know, you send me ammunition now, or, you know, by May 10th, you've got real trouble on your hands, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that right there, you know, and you know, to tie back, that's extremely compelling when you see that kind of video coming in off the battlefield,
yeah.
right? Like, that tells you that no matter what the pundits are saying, things are going badly for Russia, okay?
Right.
And so when you look at, like, a leak, you know, that, you know, what that really, what does that really mean in the context of an E4 leaking sensitive information about, you know, some reports that may have been
yeah.
written about what may have come on and off the battlefield, is that what he did actually is corroboratory and confirmatory
mm-hmm. right.
on things that we had suspected,
right.
you know, through other sources, that things were going badly for the Russians, you know, and then you've got the head of Wagner Group, you know,
right.
about 3 weeks later, a month later, after that leak, you know, videotaping, you know,
yeah.
an urgent message
mm-hmm.
to Putin, right?
Yeah.
And it was addressed to Putin. And so, you know, it's very interesting. You know, I think that you know, we're going to see, you know, when you get, out of the spring, maybe a few more weeks in, you know, when the ground is dried up, because that part of Europe is gorgeous, right? It really is. It's beautiful. But it's very wet and soggy and a real slog this time of the year, and it only gets better, you know, when things start drying out in May and June. And so I think what you're likely to see is, you know, that Ukrainian offensive is going to come on, and it's going to be, you know, it's going to be significant. So that's my assessment right now.
Yeah. Okay. So shifting away from Ukraine to China and what's going on there, the Chinese-Russian relationship seems to be moving in a closer, much closer than what it was before the war started. So how do you take what's going on with China-Russia and the lessons we've talked about this, the lessons that the Chinese have learned and how the Russians are doing things or not doing them right, and how that's kind of moving them towards looking at Taiwan as a possibility. I mean, we keep talking about it. Xi wants it. But you know, whether or not he's going to do this now or 10 years from now, I mean, that's the $64,000 question. But the feeling seems to be that, you know, this might be the time for him to do this. You've got a weak administration here. You don't have Trump. You've got people who are compromised to the nth degree for any number of reasons. So how do you, you know, sort through these kinds of issues, and where do you think this is going with the Taiwan business?
So what we've seen is that if China answers any, you know, lessons learned on watching Russia, you know, fail in the Ukraine, is that, you know, they're only using it to, they see their near neighbor who they're ideologically they're near, okay, as totalitarian regimes, and of course the Russia and the Great Soviet Union were, you know, actually begat the modern Communist Party of China, right?
Right.
But so ideologically they're close, but they do not trust each other, and so in China's worldview, you know, a weakening of their northern neighbor is desirable, right?
Yeah.
It's desirable, and not just that. I promise you that China has designs on Russian territory. You know, that they lost to Russia. Russia was one of the colonizing powers
that
took large swathes.
Well,
when you look at Vladivostok, right there, right there by, you know, the Koreas, you know, the Chinese want that back. You know, and they've said so. So they've said so, and they've said so recently. They basically adumbrated, you know, to Putin, you know, ahead of a meeting. You know, Putin came begging for support for Ukraine.
Right.
You know, send me bullets.
Yeah.
You know, send me beans, and basically the CCP, you know, adumbrated their requirements. Right. They said, well, you know, here's for your consideration. You know, we want these five or six areas, you know, back on the table for negotiations, you know, that were once ours. And it's not a small, it is not a small price. I mean, it would be a really bitter pill for, you know, any Russian administration to have to give in to that, right? So that's the first thing. The second thing is that we must remember that China and Xi Jinping are on their own timeline, period, period, okay? They could go right now today if they wanted to. Okay, it's just how much, you know, it's always a risk calculation, right? And so what we've seen, you know, we continue to watch the indications and warning around there, but since Pelosi's visit, you know, late last year, and the, you know, the kerfluffle that caused, well, the Chinese did what we have always seen them do, is that there was a significant uptick in operations around Taiwan, and they have maintained that increased posture. And what it was, so, you know, when you look at, like, after effects of Pelosi's visit and then subsequent effects, you know, also including the current speaker, okay, is that, you know, we were giving the Chinese the excuse to flex their muscles and inch closer into Taiwan to increase their intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance activities around Taiwan, which they continue to do. Just on the 27th of April and the 3rd of May this week, we've seen two combat drones, talking about drones and AI, Kevin, right? We have seen two combat-capable, very capable drones, you know, circumnavigate Taiwan in close proximity.
Staying outside of the limit, though.
Well, no. I mean, actually violating the limit, and then at the same time, what they'll do is that they'll authorize an uptick in combat flights. You know, so you'll see 30 Chinese warplanes violate, you know, Taiwanese airspace, right? And so it's this normalizing of the threat that is the most dangerous thing, because when they finally get to the tipping point, when Xi says go, your Taiwanese forces, U.S. Marines who might be, you know, there, or, you know, the Japanese who might be sitting down in the, you know, in the Nansai Shoto, right, their islands, the southern prefecture, which are within distance of Taiwan, right, that, you know, you're going to have very little reaction time, you know, and so that whole thing could be over if we continue to allow this, right?
Okay, so let me ask you this in terms of deterrence, okay? We see all of these probes, we're seeing all this kind of stuff going on. Mm-hmm. My understanding is that there still is a lot of capability that they have purchased but has not been delivered. What is your sense of that, and what can we expect if we're not going to plus these folks up to really have a deterrence that means something for Xi to be very careful about? The risk could be more greater than he wants to take.
Yeah, it's difficult, Lou. You know, you've got just this week they announced yet another delay in the delivery of paid for F-16s, right? That Taiwan had paid for, and the Taiwanese government announced it. You know that they've had yet another delay from the United States, and so, you know, what's going on behind the scene is, you know, a lot of diplomatic pressure and subversion from Chinese interests here in the United States, backdooring Congress, backdooring, you know, our stated policy, you know, to put pressure on us or to just change things.
It's not a supply problem for us. We could theoretically get this stuff to them.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
it's a political warfare problem.
Okay. So here we get to this whole question of the degree to which this administration, not just the Biden family, but mm-hmm. others, okay, mm-hmm. are compromised over anything to do with the Chinese. And if that's the case, then essentially the means necessary for a, quote, deterrent force are not going to be there, which is only going to be an incentive for Xi to say, I better do this faster rather than later.
Well, his plan
sooner rather than later.
So always remember the Chinese mantra that their plan is to win without fighting.
Right.
And so when you already look at what's the decimation of the United States all-volunteer force, the announcement last week from a Canadian member of parliament that the Canadian military had basically been relegated post-COVID mandates to, you know, to an ineffective force. They're down to 40,000 of their 100,000 authorized force, right? When you look at the weakening of them, that is in our immediate near future, okay? Within the next year or two, we will have, you will have, the all-volunteer force will be gone. We're going to continue to suffer recruiting woes. That is your single greatest deterrent in the long run, is can the United States mount an effective defense? And right now, it may seem like we've got it, okay, that we've got ships and planes and missiles and we could mount an effective defense, but, you know, if you continue to see your forces atrophy the way that, you know, the Canadian forces are atrophy, you know, it has an extremely corrosive effect on deterrence.
So not only do you have that problem, but then it's the problem that we've had discussed here before in terms of what is our capability for the 7th Fleet to actually be able to defend itself from incoming Chinese missiles, which they have thousands of them in the interior. So that we've got now 3 minutes. So quickly mention that so I can wrap it up. Oh, we have 2 minutes.
Yeah,
thank you, Laurie. I really appreciate
that.
Yeah,
so we'll have to go a little deeper on this at another time, but it's the PLA Rocket Force, and it is the secret juice of the Chinese military and the PLA that is unmatched by any other force in the world, right? And when you look at the SALT restrictions that were placed on the United States, you know, in our negotiations with the Russians, and the fact that China was never a signatory to that, and they've been able to expand their rocket forces, that right there is a game changer. You know, they can reach out and neutralize the 7th Fleet in port at Yokosuka, in a Japanese port, and never suffer the first, the consequence for doing that.
Okay. So. Well, thank you for that that optimistic note there. All right, Miss Laurie. According to my clock, I've got 2 minutes to go, okay? But maybe not. Your clock is different. Laurie's clock is the real clock.
It is 10:59.
Okay, so here we are. All right, so listen, I hope that you all have had an opportunity to listen to this. I know Laurie will send it to me, and I'll get it put out so that, because we changed the date and some people didn't get the word on it.
We posted on our website as well, WABF1480.com.
Okay, so the bottom line is that I like this Friday format. I think it's good, and I really appreciate the two guests for coming on here on a Friday. Take your time to do this, and as always, you know, for you all listening, then you're going to get the best interpretation of issues that are going on, and of course, it's from a conservative perspective, but nevertheless, it's the reality. And if we don't do things like this and bring this kind of information to you, you're not going to get the right story. And I think that it is important for us to continue to do this. And so I will be doing it. Miss Lori, thank you. Good to see you again. Commander Cox, thank you. My sponsor, thank you for coming in today.
Kevin
Spriggs.
And
I have to say, I got a car wash at his the Malbus car wash, and it is just good. And that's not because... Maybe it is, but it really is a good car wash. So go do it.
All right.
All right, guys. Y'all take care. Have a good weekend. Bye.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks, Lori.
Thank you. This is WABF Mobile Fairhope. You've been listening to the Conservative Watchdog Weekly News Review with Dr. Lou, now on Fridays, brought to you by Spriggs Enterprises, featuring those Shell gas stations in Daphne and in Malbus with a state-of-the-art car wash, as well as an anonymous sponsor. And as we mentioned, if you missed the program, you can listen to it later at WABF1480.com. The opinions and views expressed in this program are not necessarily those of this station or management.